The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. I think we all love Michael Cunningham's writing, or we wouldn't be here this evening. Without giving away any critical points about his new book, By Nightfall, I can tell you that it's about time, desire, love, death, art, and a shark. If you are or ever have been a New Yorker, you will hear and see your world rendered with a musician's ear, a poet's heart, and a critic's glint. If you are a parent, the book is often harrowing. If you think you are middle-aged, expect a challenge to your self-image. If you love literature, you'll recognize some old friends, Fitzgerald, Mann, Melville, James Joyce, among many others. If you're looking for a good book, as one of the characters says in By Nightfall, please, God, send me something to adore. This book is that thing. Please welcome Michael Cunningham.
Oh, thank you. Thank you all for coming. Can you hear me? Great, great. Oh, look, a glass of wine. You know, it would be silly not to say, go Phillies. What I would like to do, with your kind permission, is read a short section from my new novel, By Nightfall. I had to actually check to get the title right. And if it's okay with you, I would love to read the opening pages of a brand new one that isn't finished yet. Great. All right, great. Thank you. Here is a little bit from By Nightfall. Just quickly, Peter, the central character, is an art dealer, and he has just had lunch with Betty Rice, an older art dealer who has told him that she has breast cancer and wants to pass some of her artists on to him, though she says the breast cancer, it was caught in time, but it's made her realize that she doesn't want to sell art anymore. So will he take one of her artists? They're uptown in New York City, and they're going to the Metropolitan Museum. Oh, do you know the Damien Hirst shark? You know what I'm talking about, right? The big shark in the formaldehyde, because that figures prominently in this. An hour later, Peter and Betty walked together through the great hall at the Met, grand, somnolent portal into the civilized world. Why deny its satisfactions, its elephantine poise, its capacity to excite the very molecules of its own air with a sense of reverent occasion and queenly glamour and the centuries-long looting of five continents? The hall receives with a vast patience. It's the mother who will never die, and right up front are her votaries, the women of the central kiosk, elderly for the most part, kind-looking, waiting to offer information from under the enormous floral arrangement, cherry blossoms just now, that festoons the air over their heads with petal and leaf. Peter pays the admissions that he paid for lunch. They clip on the small metal circles. These things must have a name. What would it be? He to his jacket and she to the scooped neck of her black cotton sweater, which for a moment draws both their attention to her prominent freckled clavicle and the miniature gathering of wrinkles like a puckering of cloth that have settled into the skin between her breasts. Betty knows that Peter is looking, gives him back a look of what he can only call haggard flirtation, a furious sensuality, not directly sexual, but charged with some quality made up of sex and defiance, the sort of look Helen must have aimed at the Trojans. Betty Rice, a queen kidnapped by age and illness. He times his ascent of the staircase with that of Betty, who climbs at a smoker's pace. She's just had a Marlboro light in front of the museum and said, in response to the skeptical glance Peter had decided against, "Now, trust me, a cancer scare is not the time to give up smoking." At the top of the stairs, Tiepolo's Marius continues to triumph. The boy continues banging on his tambourine. On the way to the contemporary galleries, Peter pauses before the Rodin at the entrance to 19th century European. Betty gets a few paces ahead, turns, and comes back.
Still here, she says.
They came for the Hearst. Why is Peter stopping? Hasn't he seen the Rodin 1,000 times? Peter says, you know how...
Yes.
How something pops out at you sometimes. Today Rodin pops out.
Yeah, I don't know why.
Betty settles beside Peter with that aspect of mother alligator calm she can summon. This is probably how she was with her sons when they were small, when they were fascinated by something that bored her, this attitude of informed but charitable willingness.
She says, no denying its merits.
No. Here, as always, is August Nyet, a.k.a. the Vanquished, a.k.a. the Bronze Age. Perfect bronze man-child, exactly life-size, trim and lithe, holding his invisible spear. Rodin was still unknown when he sculpted and cast this naked man, sans ancient Greek musculature or French devotion to allegory. Rodin, a minor figure then, but proven right by time. The heroic was dying out. The real was arriving for a long, long stay. Now Rodin has been and gone. Yes, of course he's part of history, but new artists don't revere him. No one makes a pilgrimage. You learn about him in school. You pass his sculptures and maquettes on your way to see the Damien Hirst. Still, it's fucking bronze. It could last forever. Didn't the Koenig sphere survive 9/11? Alien archaeologists might unearth it one day, and really, would it be such bad evidence of who and what we were? August Nyet, centuries dead by then, his name lost, but his form preserved, nude, unidealized, merely young and healthy, with his life ahead of him.
Okay, Betty says.
Okay. They walk quietly and with purpose past the Carrier and de Chauve, past Jerome's Pygmalion kissing Galatea. At the gallery's far end, they turn past the books and gifts kiosk, turn again. And there it is, the shark, suspended in its pale blue, strangely lovely formaldehyde. There is the lethal perfection of its shape, and here is its maw, jagged, big as a barrel head, the business end. Is there any other creature so clearly intended to be a mouth propelled by a body? It remains a jolt. It still produces that prickle of animal panic along the surface of Peter's skin, which is, of course, one of the questions. Who isn't going to be moved by a 13-foot-long dead shark floating in a tank of formaldehyde? Peter's stomach lurches. Betty says. It has to do with the immaculate packaging, Peter thinks. The hefty but pristine white steel tank, 22 tons. The azure solution in which the creature floats. The shark is so entirely contained, so utterly dead. Its eyes opaque, its hide hoarily wrinkled. And yet...
Oh, it's something seeing it here, Betty says.
Yeah, it is something. The physical impossibility of death in the mind of someone living. Yes, it's something. Three girls and a boy, 14 or 15, circle nervously around the tank, appalled, deciding how exactly to mock it. A little boy holds his father's hand and says, "This is scary?" poses a question. A middle-aged couple stands by the shark's tail, huddled, conferring gravely in what sounds like Spanish, consulting each other as if they've been sent to do something painful but necessary for the greater good. Betty says, "This one's a female."
"Do you think they should have kept the first one?"
"Ah, there was no way Steve Cohen was going to pay $8 million and just watch the goddamn thing disintegrate."
"No, no way."
"Well, it's a little hard to see it at this point," Betty says. "I mean, there's the object, and there's Hearst's career, not to mention Hearst himself, and then there's Cohen's $8 million, and the Met thinking it's daring to show something that's been around him almost 20 years. The high school kids gather before the shark's midsection, all but trembling with fear and sexuality and disdain, speaking softly in a private language.
Peter catches bits.
"You're such a handbag." "Handbag? No, he must have misheard." "Never have. Thomas and Esme and Prue." One of the girls puts a hand on the glass, pulls it quickly away again. The other two girls shriek and run from the gallery as if their friend has set off an alarm. Betty strides up to the front of the tank, bends over slightly to see into the shark's open maw. The girl who touched the glass remains, the boy beside her. She fingers the seam of the boy's jeans. Young lovers, then. The girl's face is resolute, small-mouthed, something pious about it. She could be Amish, never mind the Courtney Love t-shirt and green leather jacket. She's a handsome and probably intelligent girl contemplating a shark alongside her boyfriend, who is gay. Anyone can see it. Does he know that yet? Does she? And Peter is briefly in love with her, or anyway, with who and what she'll become. There she is 10 years from now, in a tight little sparkly dress, laughing at a party somewhere. And then the boy whispers to her, and they leave, and Peter will never see her again. It's impressive, Betty says of the shark. You let yourself think, oh, it's a gesture, it's just a dead shark. Every natural history museum is full of them. But then you stand in the gallery with it, and, well, Betty has grown bottom-heavy with age. She's wearing black Reeboks. As she leans unafraid toward the mouth of the shark, she's touching, but not heroic. No, she is perhaps heroic in her way, but she is not potent. She does not possess even Ahab's doomed and fanatic grandeur, though she has, in her life, had some measure of his crazy conviction. Think of the artist she's taken on. But now, on a Sunday afternoon at the Met, she's an old woman looking into the mouth of a dead shark. Peter goes and stands beside her. It's an impressive gesture, he says. Behind Peter's and Betty's dim reflections on the glass, the shark's jaws gape. There are the rows of lethal, serrated teeth, and beyond, pickled white, is the orifice itself, which takes on the shade of the solution's blue, grayed, and deepened as it recedes into the shark's own inner darkness. Betty has not told Peter the truth. Not the whole truth. The surgeon didn't get all the cancer. She's not going to be all right. Peter knows this with a tingling immediacy that's like the creaturely alertness produced by the shark itself. An infinitesimal length of tape self-erases in his brain, and he'll never know if he understood at lunch or later that Betty is, in fact, dying, and will do so sooner rather than later. That's why she's closing the gallery right now. That's why her husband is leaving Columbia. Peter reaches over and takes her hand. It's more or less involuntary, and only after he's touched her does he pause to wonder, is this ridiculous? Is it melodramatic? Will she rebuke him? Her fingers are surprisingly soft and crepey, an old woman's. She squeezes his hand with hers, gently and quickly. They hold hands for a few seconds, then part. If the gesture was excessive or false, if it was self-dramatizing on Peter's part, Betty doesn't seem to mind. Not now. Not in front of the shark. Thank you. Thank you. All right, this is the brand spanking new one. It's called Sleepless. We've been awake 3 or 4 days now. It isn't the drugs or the music or the dying dog. It isn't only that. It's more because we've gotten too nervous and interested to sleep. We've been so many places. We stopped setting our clocks long ago when we realized it was always going to be too late. That doesn't mean we abandoned hope. We just settled into other ambitions. A day's pay for a day's work. A safe place to park for the night. The pure, windy nowhere of a proper high. We had Pilot, our shepherd retriever mix, who took everything that happened with the same baffled good cheer. We had Heather, our sister mother, who'd had the good sense to jump into our truck and leave it all behind. The waitress apron, the Pittsburgh rain. If you're willing to call us pilgrims, you could say we were taking the little path. Wherever you look for us, we've always just left. But when your dog starts sighing into herself, when you know from her eyes that she's ready to disappear, you stop driving and pick her a spot. You get her a little stillness. You make her a bed out of quilts and towels. You use the last of your money to rent her a house. This house is far north, far enough that in summer, night brushes across it all like a silk scarf. It's granite and sky here, witch pines, the blue-black mirror of the ocean. And us, a strange dream this old house is having. Pilot panting softly in her corner. No longer paying attention to the food and water we keep putting out. Trask and I still using, and Heather not. She's got a plan, massage school, Swedish, or shiatsu. There are arguments for both. Tonight, our third or fourth sleepless one, Trask and I make out on the sofa, sit with Pilot as she huffingly contemplates her final mystery, watch the ocean turn black, read the bloated old magazines, and play the old music we found here, our favorite being John Coltrane blowing into his horn, "Do you love me? Do you love me? Do you love me?" Trask and I do a slow, snaky dance to the Coltrane, blissed out on the last of the Dilaudid we copped in Burlington. Heather says, "You boys are too much." It's a surprising thing for her to say. I'd assumed we were too little. Heather stands solidly in her lace-up boots, hands on hips. Her platinum hair is the brightest spot in the room. She could be the wife of the music. Everything about her is famous to us. Trask says, "Yeah, our careers as modern dancers were tragically cut short by circumstances beyond our control." Heather shakes her head over the oddness of us. I could say something like, "Don't go, but we all know it's time." She's ready for a mailbox and a washing machine. She can't survive anymore on whatever Trask and I don't need for ourselves. Later, Trask stands with me on the front porch, gaunt and blue-white as a medieval saint. Heather's inside, sitting in a murky pool of lamplight, reading one of her holy books. Out here, it's strands and helixes of stars. It's the single hour of true night. And I know what Trask is thinking, because I'm thinking the same thing. The earth is forgetting us. Look at all that it's forgotten already. Look at what it chooses to remember. Wind-gnarled trees and rocks washed by tides. A single star riding in a pool of tide water. Trask says, "Hey." I say, "Hey yourself." Trask and I don't need to converse much. We're thinking now about burying Pilot in the pine grove we found above the house. We're thinking of ourselves as two figures in a bus station parking lot, getting smaller and smaller as we wave goodbye to Heather's bus. Trask says, "It might be nice to stay somewhere for a while," which is not what I was thinking. "So we'll stay here?" I ask. Trask hoots out a laugh, tussles my hair. "Yeah, right," he says, "and we pay for the castle. How exactly?" I laugh along with him. Money is one of the questions I tend to forget about. We have a good long laugh together, each of us cracking the other one up. We seem to be laughing about the joke of the world. Its avenues and palaces, its immaculate stores, blazing and trumpeting along as Trask and I cavort on the edges, little clownish guys, all battered hat and broken shoe, shuffle dancing, laughing at each other, when we'd once expected to become kings. "Pilot is disappearing," I say. "Yeah," Trask answers. "She's been a good dog." Now, Trask believes there's no home in the world, not for anybody, but I maintain that it's exactly the opposite. It's all homes. Some of them are rich and comfortable, and some of them are bleak, but even the worst of them, even the parking lot behind the Stuckey's where we got robbed by the handsome hitchhiker on the hottest day of the year, even that gas station men's room in Nashville, they were homes. And now we're here. Trask has my hair to touch. I have the bones of his spine. Then it's us, driving into a future that looks like a preview of the past. Pilot is wrapped in her quilt underground. Heather is on her bus. I sneak a look at Trask's profile as he shifts gears and curses the dying transmission. It still surprises me, the fact of him. Here is his glowy pallor, his modest jut of nose. Trask and I are lovers, but we're not boyfriends. We're too brotherly for romance. We're twins born of different mothers. Kissing Trask, poking around with him, is like kissing my improved self. I felt strange about it at first. Strange, though, always turns out to be the new normal. Our radio plays the passing songs. Trask finger drums our steering wheel in time to the music, which is his way of keeping the truck alive. If there's enough music in the truck, if there's enough intention, if there are maps and Slim Jims and crushed Coke cans, if he taps the wheel and smacks the dashboard every now and then, the truck won't blow its transmission. We're going south again. Now, right now, we're rumbling through the endless forests of Massachusetts, which turns its woods to the highway. In there, on the far side of the trees, the mansions of dead millionaires give back birds and branches from their blind windows. Cracked fountains offer little cups of sky. Here on the highway, it's wind-stirred trash and the occasional deceased raccoon. Here inside the cab, it's music and tapping and silent prayer. Live on, transmission, at least until we've got more cash. Trask says, let's stop in Fall River. It's the first thing he said in more than 300 miles. Okay, I answer. I could ask him why, but I decide not to. I've learned that all my questions have answers attached, and the answers arrive in their own time, as if they're on a line that stretches only so far before it snaps back. Sometimes it's best to wait for that to happen. We pull into Fall River at that hour of early evening when the lowering sun sets it all ablaze, when the humblest of human works is exalted, when it's most obvious that something, even if it's only sunlight, pays attention to every mobile station and McDonald's, every auto salvage yard. The sky is thumbed and streaked with gold. As we drive across the rust-scabbed bridge, it throws its net of lattice shadow over us, while Fall River shines on its hills like a consecrated city. It's Fall River, I say. Yes, it is, Trask agrees. We drive down Central, past the stores that haven't gone out of business yet. Fall River is dying the way Pilot did, sighing its days away, growling softly into itself. Fall River was born when beaver pelts were treasures, and it hasn't been born again since. People amble along Central, unhurried, because there's no place to go they haven't already been. Right away, I think I see my mother, but it's not her. It's a hefty woman who looks like her, wobbling along in a sweater on a hot day, wearing whatever grace she's got left to muster, carrying a bag of empty cans. That's not my mother, I say by way of observation. Nope, Trask answers, it's not. We give ourselves a brief tour. It is all precisely itself, minus a few shops and diners. We drive by Dunkin' Donuts, where younger versions of us still hang out, sucking cigarettes and clocking the passing car. There's a particular kid who resembles me, same ratty hair and bad skin, pulling on a cigarette and talking away, telling the daily beads. He's speaking into the silence of the others, like I used to do. Grubby as he may be, he shines with an optimism the others don't care to put out. He believes there are things to talk about, places to leave to. We drive on. I never thought Trask was responsible for the accident. How can anybody be responsible for an accident? You're motoring along, happy and free. You're blasting your favorite song on the dashboard radio, and Trask passes you the joint as you narrate the new details of your amazing future, and you drop the joint, and suddenly there's a tree in front of you. That happens sometimes. Trask has been with me ever since. That's the saintliness of him. I do my best to resemble myself, but it gets harder over time. I wonder if that's why we've come back to Fall River, to remind me of who I used to be. I don't have the language or the ambition to put that thought into disappearance. I don't have the language or ambition to put that thought into a sentence. Instead, I say, it's all disappearing. It is, Trask answers. We've been gone a year, or maybe it's more like two. Time doesn't obey the calendar when you live the way we've been living. We drive by my old building, which is still defiantly yellow, still offering to passersby its droopy porches and its garden of thriving thorn. It is now untenanted by anyone we know. I wonder if we've come here to look for my mother, though there's no reason to think she'd come back. What a dump, I say, though I don't exactly mean it. On rare occasions, I tell Trask something that isn't quite true. The truth is, I love that old wreck of a building. Our apartment smelled like perfume and wet dog. My mother made dinner every night, even on the worst ones. It wasn't her fault that the world of money and surprises was too much for her. Here and there, we pass people we used to know. Here's deranged Mike, sitting on a playground swing set, wondering over his shoes. There is pretty enough Darlene in cowboy boots. There are Mr. Floyd, who has no known first name, and the Dutra twins, and Edie, who got in the paper for turning 100 and still being vicious. We do not stop for any of these people, and they don't seem to see us driving by.
We have become less visible from being gone. When dark comes, we go and park behind the school, a big elephant-colored building haunted only by itself. I wonder if we're going to break in and have a ramble through the hallways, but it seems we're going to keep sitting in the truck. We smoke for a while in silence. Then Trask says, I hated this school. Me too. No, you didn't. You liked it. You like everything. Not everything. Trask leans over and kisses me, harder than usual. I kiss back, but he's crushing his teeth into mine. It's more like a mouth punch than a kiss. There's no returning it. I can only hold on. I put my hand in his hair. When he pulls his mouth away, I say, there's nothing to do about love, huh? Trask just nods and lights another Camel. We sit there for a while, watching the school get that much older. The lower windows sport construction paper flowers. We can see the upper half of a globe. Planet Earth, right where it's always been. Then we're off to the Blue Point. It's sparse this early. Harry and Everett and Little Harry are on their stools, where we left them however long ago. They nod to us, as if we saw them only last night. Time passes differently for them. Noreen stands behind the bar, grandly enormous, coral-lipped. She says, well, as I live and breathe. Hey, Trask says. I smile. And just exactly where have you motherfuckers been? She asks. She's like a landmass, Noreen. She's geological. You could moor a ship to her flanks. Here and there, Trask answers. Noreen's gray hair won't stay in its rubber band. Her personal bigness will barely stay in her flesh. She's wearing the flower-covered dress that shows her cleavage. Behind her, bottles glow amber in the light. And you didn't find any place better than here. She laughs, a big raucous sound that comes hackingly out of her smoky depths. Trask doesn't answer that, and I don't either. Trask sidles up to Little Harry, slips him one of our last 20s, gets the tiny envelope in return, discreetly, under the bar. This hasn't changed either. Before we duck into the men's room, Trask leans over the bar and speaks to Noreen, softly, too soft for me to hear. Noreen listens, nods. She wears an uncertain look. Trask motions me into the men's. We do the coke in two big hits under the fluorescence. The walls are full of messages. Lit up from the coke, Trask says, yeah, Fall River isn't so bad. We've been to worse places, wouldn't you say? Well, we have, but we've been to better places, too. I say, I like that house of ours. It was a shithole, Billy, Trask says, and we couldn't even afford that. Well, Pilot is buried there. We dance to the horns. We fall briefly back into our customary silence, but I decide not to let it hold. I say, Heather was like the music. You could say that. You miss her, I say. Well, you know, hey, it was only a matter of time, right? Driving nowhere with two losers, that's a future a girl would want. He turns around, unbuttons to piss. As he's pissing, the toilet seat falls and spatters him with his own pee. Fuck, he says. He kicks the toilet bowl, dick still out. His boot slides squealingly across the porcelain. More piss splatters around. Peeing, Trask pivots and bangs his head against the towel dispenser. His forehead makes a melony sound on the metal. I grab him from behind. I hold him, just close. Fuck, he whispers, softly like an endearment. It's all right, I tell him. This is not entirely true, but it's the thing to say, like saying good night when we go to bed. Trask shrugs me away, not ungently. He tucks his dick back into his jeans and walks out. I follow. Back in the bar, Noreen has set up two shots for us. She says, drinks for the conquering heroes. We down the shots. Trask talks quietly again to Noreen, who nods her vast head. I'm not meant to listen. I tune in on the jukebox, which is playing a song about a good woman gone wrong. After a while, Trask says to me, I'm going to go see if Kathy's still around. Kathy was his girlfriend. Maybe she's still around. Maybe she isn't mad anymore. I'll come, I ask. Better if I see her alone, he answers. He stands with me for a moment. We can't kiss, not in front of Everett and the Harrys. See you soon, he says. Yes, I answer. There's something I'd like to tell him. Something about love and crazy gratitude. Something about a forgiveness we share. I want to hold him, which we can't do here. I want to bite him. I want to put a benediction on his suffering, wounded head. My lips are sewn shut, though, and my boots are soldered to the floor. All I can manage is a modest smile. He does his best to smile back, but his mouth won't move that way at present. He looks at me, and then he's gone. Would you like another drink, sweetheart? Noreen asks. Trask has a little bit of money in his pocket, but I don't tell her that. I just say, no thanks, I'm not thirsty now. Noreen says, how about you go in the back and bring those cases of beer that are out there? I'm getting too old to have cases of beer around like I've been doing. I say, okay. I go out the back, past the toilet stalls, past the little room called office, where Noreen figures the orders and the money and whatever else she does. I look in. The room is cozy in its way, comfortably cluttered, with a modest window perfectly centered on the moon of a streetlight. It smells like Noreen, like petrified tulips. There's a cot there, narrow, but fine for one smallish person. Then I'm out and back, under the Fall River stars, which shine like they do everywhere, the same for the victorious and the fallen, the same for the people who are neither, who are just marking their time. Here are three cases of beer, neatly stacked by the delivery man. Here's the parking lot with its veins of weed and the black hulk of the dumpster and the chain-link fence and the rear end of the Walgreens. And here's that buzz in the air, like plucked wires mixed in with the low huff, huff, huff. It is, I think, the sound the earth makes as it spins through the black, chucked at by fists of dust and ice. A looseness that's opened in my skull lets me hear it. It's the only thing I've never told anyone. It's private. I'm not who I was, but I can hear the world turning. The sound is always in my ears. I'm like a horn being played. But there's the beer to bring in and the pissed-on men's room floor to mop. I can wipe down the bottles and refill the peanut bowls. Noreen is stingy with her peanuts. I won't be like that. I give myself another minute to stand in the bright and dark, listening. I'll wait here, right here, for Trask, so he knows where to find me when he comes back. I lift up a case of beer and carry it inside. Thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you. You know, one of the things that I love most about doing a reading tour is the chance to actually talk to people who read books, who could be doing anything in the world tonight and have come out to hear a novelist read from his works. So I would be so happy to talk a little bit, to answer any kind of questions that anybody might want to bat around. And the first one is always the hardest. Yes, over there, please. There's a cordless. Nothing like a cordless mic.
I've never done that before. Been the first one.
Congratulations.
I read your op-ed piece Sunday in the Times.
Yeah.
And loved it. I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And you know, people don't talk that much about the rhythm of writing. And I wonder what made you decide to write that, or it must have been something you think about a lot.
The second piece, the one I just.
Found in Translation.
Yes. Honestly, I had a piece in last Sunday's Times about translation, about the sort of mutability of language and how it's all a translation. Even the original is a sort of imperfect translation of the perfection you had hoped to achieve on the page and that you never achieve. I had frankly written it as a talk to give in Florence, and I gave the talk in Florence, and somebody from the Times happened to be there, and they offered to run it. But I had really meant it for an audience of Europeans who are I think probably it's safe to say more aware of the vagaries of translation than some of us here in America are. I was invited to Florence. I had to talk about something, and so I thought, oh, translation, sure.
Well, it seemed to be about more than just translation. Seemed to also be about a writer and his own rhythms and the rhythm of what he writes and how significant that is to him.
Absolutely.
People don't really think about that all that much.
No, absolutely. I don't remember if I said this in the piece, but I always tell my students that a paragraph of any story they write, read aloud, should sound like something to somebody who doesn't understand English.
Right.
You know, there should be
exactly.
you should be able to kind of boom, 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 two longs and a short. I get very cranky about that with my students, and they love me for it, of course.
I've taken to reading books aloud to myself. Not every book that I read,
great.
But certain books where it's very important. There are certain writers where it's more important than other writers, but so I don't do it with every because it's very time consuming.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure,
but it's interesting. And it's
yeah, and you know, for a writer, there's no better bullshit detector than reading what you've written aloud to yourself. You can tell where the dead spots are in ways that it's almost impossible to see on the page, and you often end up cutting some of the stuff that you thought was so brilliant. Because when you read it, it has to live in the air, you know. It has to feel like something when you're shouting it into you, like a crazy person standing in your underwear in your bedroom. It's not the most heroic image, but there you have it. It's the life of a novelist. Oh, that's the thing I'm not supposed to fall off. Okay, I was warned. There's a funny thing here I'm standing on no one's ever fallen off, and I was thought I might be the first one. I still might be. Thank you. Anybody else? Yes, in front. Oh, sir. No, by all means. Then you're next.
Actually, I'm a little nervous.
We're all a little nervous. I'm nervous up here.
No, but the funny thing is I'm a television reporter, so I shouldn't be nervous. But your writing does this to me. That's what happens. Congratulations on all your success. Anybody who can get me to read literary fiction deserves the Pulitzer.
Oh, thank you.
And obviously, I write too, and the thing that really resonated with me is that I came through your writing through the novel Flesh and Blood.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was one of the only literary... Remember I was talking to you just a few seconds ago. It was one of the only literary novels that I had ever read where you could actually feel the emotions of the characters through your skin. Everything was sort of seared into my brain. And I'm wondering if... And I noticed in your writing you use a lot of scenes instead of long pages of page after page of page of exposition, which seems to, you know, it's nice for a while, it goes in, but those scenes, like when you talked about, because I just finished By Nightfall in my car just a few minutes ago, Betty walking up the steps and she goes, you know, now's not the time to quit smoking. I remember that scene. I don't think I'll ever forget that scene.
Oh, great.
So do you think now, you know, in the 21st century that more scenic dramatic writing is the way to go versus, you know, exposition?
You know, that's a great question. I've been around long enough to understand that our collective sense of what constitutes good writing keeps changing. When I was starting out, it was all like Ray Carver and Ann Beatty and Gordon Lish and these minimalists, and I just looked sort of like a crazy person next to them, and was not popular. But then that kind of washes on, and I think we're in a really interesting period in American literature right now. I could name a half dozen really meaningful brand new books off the top of my head. But I think we are coming out of a sort of longish period of a kind of icy detachment in our literature, a kind of wry remove, like you, the author, are sort of the smartest living human being, and you are offering up these characters in part to show the reader that neither you nor the reader really needs to worry about them because they're just ridiculous. I was never much interested in those books, and I could name any number of them, including some that have been enormously successful. And time will move on, and fashions will continue to change. But I'm a feelings guy. I don't have it in me to be wry or ironic, especially, and I don't really have it in me to write about characters I don't love. As opposed to a writer I hugely admire, Jonathan Franzen, and I am a lovely person for saying that because he sells 1,000 times more books than I do. But you know, he doesn't like those people. Those people are meant to be sort of ridiculous, and yet I feel like he pulls it off. But I'm not that kind of writer. Jonathan and I are very, very, very different that way. Thank you. Thank you. Up front, here comes the mic.
You have a good amount of fantasy and fantastic fiction in mm-hmm. your works, and I wonder if you're willing to go for a World Fantasy Award at some point, Nebula, maybe.
Oh, if I would write a proper fantasy sometime?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think about that. I love science fiction and fantasy. I'm not sure how good at it I would be, but. You know, I'm a huge fan of the quote unquote genres. We were just talking about Dennis Lehane, who I think is great, though you know they sell him in airports. But who cares? And people like Samuel Delaney and Ursula K. Le Guin. My God, I bow down to those people.
And regarding them, do you think this country deserves the literature that they get?
Does a country deserve the literature it gets? That is such a good question. I think a country probably gets the literature it wants. And that may not always be such good news. But I can tell you this: when I travel around, there was. I'm a little out of date now, but there was a great deal of interest in much of Europe in American fiction. A little bit like we were about foreign films in the 70s and 80s. Even the French told me, "Oh no, we love American fiction. French fiction is arid and dull." And I don't know about French fiction being arid and dull, but I do feel, again, like we're in a really rich period of American fiction. And part of it involves the sort of breaking down of the walls between genres and the questioning of what's quote-unquote serious and what ought to be considered serious, but it's over in the silly section of the bookstore and people don't read it. So that was a long way of saying, yes, I'd love to write a fantasy novel. I teach in a prison, and they're all into fantasy. It's hard to find a story that doesn't involve a 7-foot-tall blue woman with 7 breasts. Oh, I did fall off the thing. Thank you. Maybe one or two more, and then I will release you into the night. Yes, sir, back there.
You just talked about loving your characters. I wonder what drew you to these two young protagonists in this new untitled work yet.
Why? What is there? What is there to love about two drug-addled losers? You might ask. Let's just say that I have moved on, and now find myself alive and well and standing soberly in front of you all. But I was not always thus. Nothing I write is ever directly autobiographical, but there was a period in my life that I haven't really written about yet that I'm sort of trying to get at. I wasn't sort of working class like these guys, but well, let's just say it, I completely pissed away my 20s on drugs. And I'm interested in that. So yeah, I mean, I have compassion for these guys. I have to. I was these guys. Yeah. Are we done? Should we say goodnight? A couple more? Two more? Yes, great.
I think this is a question about the writing process.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about needing to read aloud, to read your own works aloud.
Yeah.
And I noticed you marking some things. Were you editing as you went?
I was. Mr. Obsessive. I was actually cutting some lines as I went along. It is very much a work in progress. You know, the ink is still wet, and I would get to a line and think, oh no, that one stinks. And I'm not going to make these people listen to that line. And you know, Mr. Obsessive, if they would let me, and if I didn't have other things to do, I would go from bookstore to bookstore and, you know, pick up published books. Yeah. Well, of other people's too. Don't get me started on that. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? Just tearing out random pages of other people's books. This page is terrible. No, of my own. Because you know, it never feels finished. It never feels good enough. You simply have to make peace with the fact that you have taken a novel as far as you can take it. And the book represents the limits of your ability now. And you will take what you've learned from writing this one and write, you hope, a better one. You hope you'll write the ultimate one, and you never do. Because we're spending our whole lives learning how to write novels, and we die still trying to learn how to write a novel. One more over there? Yes.
I'm wondering what you're reading now that's feeding your writing.
Oh, what am I reading now that's feeding my writing? Well, I can barely say this with a straight face, but I spent the summer reading, yes, Proust. Finally, the old thing breaks down and reads In Search of Lost Time, which, as we know, is vast and exasperating and thrilling and all sorts of things. So I kind of feel like I've been in a foreign country for a few months where they speak another language, but I am especially thrilled with the Jennifer Egan book, A Visit from the Goon Squad. I admire the new Jonathan Franzen book. I'm talking about, you know, people who are out there right now. I've just started it. Is it Tim McCarthy C? Just the letter C. I'm sorry, Tom McCarthy. Yeah. Which is kind of fabulous. And I'm always reading like six things at once. Oh, you know, there's a marvelous writer who is not nearly widely enough read named Joanna Scott. It's not her most recent, but a book of hers called The Mannequin should be wildly more famous than it is. And I still go back to it and get nourishment from that. There, that's a few. All right, my dears. Out into the beautiful night with you. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.